are on time. As you remember, we kind of meet right after session, and I'm sorry you have very little time to have your lunch and then come here and talk about our kids, but we're going to do the best we can to bring you together on time. And I believe that some members will be eating lunch at this table, but we'll do our best. I'm glad to see you here, and thank you to the department for your quick response. I think that we're going to do our best to, again, to try to coordinate with the House to make sure that we have, you know, relevant information as information comes to us, as proposals from different members and the governor are coming forward. We just want to make sure that in our policy committee we have a clear plan to address some of those recommendations that are coming from our budget committee, as well as, you know, kind of the different initiatives that our stakeholders and our committee members really want to move forward. I believe that you have a copy of the agenda for today. And what we, members, what I am planning to do is really make sure that our policy committee will have extensive reviews of the policies that are attached to some of the recommendations that are coming forward through the finance committee, so that we are clear about really what is that we need to do here. The recommendations that came from the governor's office in terms of budget included a few programs, a few policy initiatives that I believe we need to review very thoroughly. One of them was a surprise to me, but it was a very pleasant surprise, which was the ELL initiative, the English Language Learning increase for $8.59 million. For some of the members that were with me in 2006, you probably remember that this was an issue that I really wanted to work on, you know, really the day after I was elected. And began to meet with the department. Mrs. Montaño was in my office, if you recall, Mrs. Montaño. We had extensive conversations about what this program does, what your staff is doing, how the districts are implementing ELL programs and initiatives. I had an opportunity to meet with the director of the ELL program, Valeria Silva, that was the director at that time for St. Paul, but now she's the superintendent for St. Paul, and talked to us about the great initiatives that St. Paul was pursuing. And then later on, the whole issue of the regional centers for excellence that you have been really guiding and putting in place to really address some of the issues that are challenging some of the schools that serve the lowest income students in our community, and challenges with achievement gap, and how you are incorporating some new initiatives to work on that. So I thought that for today, we're going to take those two issues, since the administration is asking for increasing funding in those areas, and I thought that it will be important for you to know what are the policies that guide these two areas, and what is the department doing in terms of implementation. So I have asked Ms. Butler to provide an overview of the policy aspects that really guide the work that we do in these two areas, so that you will have that in front of you as policymakers, and you will know. My hope is that you will file this in your office so that we can come back to it, and that you can talk to your staff about perhaps, you know, helping you get back to this, because we are going to probably have some bills related to this in terms of structuring some policy directions for these two areas. So, Ms. Butler, could you help us review this?
Excuse me, Madam Chair, members, I think on your stack of papers are some statutory language and some rules. So I'll first maybe go through the statutory language. We have an English Language Learner or English Learners Act, which is sections 124D through 0.58 through 124D.64. They those sections cover many things, but there's definitions, but there's also then a section on the rights of parents and what notice the districts need to give to the students' parents, as well as then just general requirements for programs, which is in 124D.61. And this, the types of services and that the programs or the districts have to provide for their English learner programs. Then there's also technical assistance, which is a short section which directs the commissioner to provide the assistance to the districts that receive the aid. Then the next section is prohibiting discrimination in programs in 124D.64. Kind of within there is a section relating to a rule, which is not necessarily for English language learner programs, but there's the 124D.645 is the multiracial diversity, which led to a rule being adopted by the agency. And then finally, in 124D.65 is the actual program aid. So then it also does have some implications with the records that have to be kept, dates for applying for the money because with their programs and participations of various schools. And then another section that's tacked on the back is related to teachers. So that's 122A.19 is the bilingual and English as a second language teachers and their licenses, which leads us into the rule language that's separated out from the packet of statutes. And there, those are the rules that pertain to teacher licensure. So there's the one for the teachers of bilingual and bicultural education, which is 8710.4150. And then there's also a license for teachers of English as a second language, which is 8710.4400. And then those would be the teacher licenses rules are then are developed and amended by the Board of Teaching. So that's where those come from.
Members, for each of our committees, when we are reviewing an issue, we're going to do an overview of the policy and the rule that is in place before we start the conversation so that you will have the guiding principles with you. Every time we have a conversation about a policy issue, we're going to kind of follow this format in which you will receive a copy. Ms. Butler will help us with this in terms of getting us the language, both rule and policy, and then we will dive into a presentation that talks about the implementation and how this is actually being done at the state level and the local level. We wish we could have more people today representing districts. Unfortunately, our timing, but is complicated. But we are going to have a staff person coming to work with us as of tomorrow, and so we will have better coordination with the local districts to have a presentation from local districts who are also working on innovative models to implement these programs. So welcome to our committee, and if you could go ahead and introduce yourselves and start your presentation.
Thank you. Madam Chair, buenos dias, and congratulations.
Thank you.
Members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Jessie Montano. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for the Minnesota Department of Education. To my left is Lee Slisher. Lee is a supervisor for the Student Support Division, and one of the programs that she works with is the English Learner Program. Madam Chair, members of the committee, this is a group of students that is very near and dear to my heart. I was one of the people who initially drafted the very first legislation for these students, which tells you how long I've been around. It is also a population that is very near and dear to the commissioner. We want to make sure in the agency that as we look at achievement gap, looking at the numbers that we have seen in terms of where Minnesota is at with its achievement gap, that these students are given all the skills necessary to achieve. We know by looking at some of our numbers, and Lee will go over those with you, that these students need the kind of support that is going to enable them to get the type of academic English language proficiency to enable them to be successful. We also want to make sure that we get these students to high school so that they can graduate and then ultimately be college and career ready. That is, those are the goals behind the agency looking at this population and making sure that what we are about is success for all students. And this is, a population that we want to make sure when we say all, we do mean all. We are prepared this morning to do an overview with respect to the population in Minnesota, who they are, what the numbers look like, the languages that we work with, in terms of how successful are they being academically, and then the types of services that the department provides. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Lee, and we'll be happy to respond to any questions.
Thank you. Good morning and or good afternoon, and thank you for this opportunity to talk about English learner programs in Minnesota. With Jesse's introduction, I will just jump right into the background information, some of the background information that we've prepared. As of final data 2010-11, there are 63,608 English learners in Minnesota schools. That number preliminarily in the current year is up at about more around 65,000 students. It is represents approximately 8% of the total student enrollment. And if we look at the 63,000 in 10-11, represents an increase of almost 8% of the total number of English learners from the year 05-06. So the English learner population continues to grow as the total student population, as you know, continues to be more flat or even decline in some areas. But this is a population that continues to grow in our state. This slide, which I don't know how well it came out on your paper, but this slide represents the numbers of English learners in Minnesota the same school year, but it gives you an idea of the grade level at which the students are identified. And the red line represents 05-06, and the blue line represents 10-11. And as you can see, the majority of our English learners are younger students, kindergarten, first, second, third, fourth, fifth grade, sixth grade, seventh grade. We start to see that decline. And as we're going to look at graduation rates in a slide or two, you know, we do know that we are losing from school numbers of students that is an uncomfortable number of students to lose from school of English learners.
Yes. Excuse me. Miss Lehler?
Slisher. Yep. Slisher.
Slisher. Thank you. Senator Nelson.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. I was just, I had a question about the graph that we're on here, and I'm wondering if the greater incidence at the early grades is a result of actually the birth rates, or is it because are we seeing in the upper grades more students graduating out of our ELL programs, or is it, do we have fewer older students coming in that are ELL learners?
I think you've touched on a few of the reasons that we see more numbers at the lower ends, the numbers of students coming in and the growing population coming in, as well as, and as we look at the graduation rates, we know that not all of the students who start with us in that cohort are graduating. And so I'm not, you know, we can look deeper into the exact reasons for these numbers and what we could discover further about that. But yeah, I think that you've addressed a few of the reasons that we see numbers like this.
Madam Chair.
Thank you. Senator Nelson.
I think the reason that this probably jumped out at me is I know several years ago in my district, there was immense challenges because we had a number of new learners who were ELL learners, but they were older learners, and that presents even a greater challenge. And so what I was trying to distill on is do we have lower numbers of older ELL learners that are entering the system? Because that's kind of what this looks like, but I'm not exactly sure that that's what these numbers are saying.
Ms. Montaño.
Senator Nelson, Madam Chair, to add to that, we do know, and as you are very correct, that the older the student is, the more difficulty they have, and we do know that we do have a difficult time getting them to stay in school. Most of the time when they do stay in school, they stay beyond the 18 years of age because they want that diploma. However, most of them give up long before they even, you know, get to the age of 18. I don't know that this represents the number of students that we enroll at the higher grades, but it does represent the fact that we do have a difficult time maintaining students because, as Ms. Lisher indicated, the numbers of ELL students continues to increase, and so we do know that the numbers, going back to when I was working, you know, very closely with the programs, that we always have had larger numbers at the elementary grade levels, and then they seem to decrease if we look at trend data as we get into the higher grades. And much of it is due, and I think Ms. Lisher will provide you with some information in terms of the difficulty and what does it mean to be language proficient and have the skills that make you college and career ready.
Thank you.
Thank you. Please continue. Just a, you know, a brief comment in here. I think that I am very interested in dissecting some of these data with you to bring more information about this because I think that part of what members have expressed is really desire to learn more about the early years, learn more about, you know, what do we do with students who have academic preparation and no language skills versus the students who have no academic preparation and no language skills. Age is a big issue in education. But also the conversation about increasing funding for the 7 years versus 5 years. You know, I, as a person who learned this language at age 23, understand that you could, given the resources, learn English in 1 year. Yet, you do need resources in order to do that intense training. So I am quite interested in learning about the argument of why we need to expand to 7 years versus the 5 years. Some schools have said very clearly to me, we need the resources. The 5 or 7 years, it's questionable. And research indicates, you know, that we, you know, quality instruction could be done in a fewer number of years. But, you know, for some kids, it may take longer. So I think that understanding these numbers is absolutely relevant to this committee and really figuring out how do we put together recommendations in policy to address the issue of funding.
Madam Chair, I think we are prepared to answer some of the questions that you just raised because the presentation does go into what does it mean to learn English, what are the variables that students, you know, have to deal with. So I believe that Ms. Lisher will be covering some of those areas. So
wonderful.
That's good.
Thank you. Please proceed.
So to continue on with a little bit about background of English learners in Minnesota, wanted to point out that English learners must and do participate in the state's accountability system and testing. English learners are included in AYP and the new MMR calculations. And additionally, there's a separate accountability for English learners known as the Adequate Measurable Achievement Objectives, or AMAOs. And the AMAOs look at progress in English language development as well as
the rates at which kids become proficient, English learners come proficient, based on our English language development assessment, which I'm going to get into a little bit later, as well as how are the students doing in the content areas of math, reading, language arts, and science. So with that kind of little transition, I wanted to show you a little bit about, with some achievement data, this slide shows a comparison of how English learners are doing on our math, reading, and science assessments compared to all students. And, you know, just as, at a glance, you can see that more English learners are not proficient, do not meet the achievement levels than the all-student group. And as we were discussing a little bit earlier, as well, when we look at the graduation rate for all students versus the graduation rate for English learners with the four-year graduation rate cohort, we see that the percentage of English learners graduating is only at around 50% of the cohort.
Members, I'm sorry, it's just very difficult to read these graphs. I have a bigger image, but please go ahead.
And we can probably provide that in larger size for you. Make sure that that gets sent over.
Please. That would be appreciated, I think.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Would it help if she just summarized what's on the graphs?
I think so. Yeah,
oh,
you
I'm
do.
Sorry.
You need to do that because they're incredibly small, so it's hard to
do. Do you want
to
me
read.
To go back to graduation rate?
Please go ahead. And yeah, you need to...
Okay, I'm sorry.
An overview of this.
The this graph is showing in the for statewide for all students in the 4 year four-year mm-hmm. cohort with a count of 54,731 students graduating, which is 76.9% of the cohort. 9,614 students, or 13.5% of the students in that cohort, continued on in school and so went beyond the 4 years to a fifth or sixth year. 4.8% of the all-student group, or 3,401 students, dropped out, and 3,463 students, or 4.9% of the cohort, we don't know what happened to those students. So that's the graduation rate for all students. If we compare that with statewide English learners, we can see that 2,628 students, or 52% of the EL cohort, graduated. 1,355 students, or 26.8% of the students, continued, which is, you know, more students continuing than in the all-student group, so that's a good thing. 10% of the cohort dropped out, 513 students, and 552 students, or 10.9%. We have an unknown, we're in the unknown category.
Excuse me, Ms. Lesher, when you say unknown, there is a category of dropout, so they're gone. We don't know what happened to them. And then the unknown, what's the difference between the two?
Madam Chair, when we a dropout is a student that the school has or the district has officially reported to MDE that the student has dropped. They went through the official process of filling out the district doesn't know what happened to the student. With the unknown, the student just left, and the district didn't officially drop the student, and therefore MDE does not really know what happened to that student. We just have no data, no information about the student, and the district did not officially drop them.
It's a big number. Senator Wigger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Slisher, the graduation rate over all states 76.9. I think nationally that puts us in the middle of the pack, maybe at 25 for so in terms of all the states. The rate for ELL English learners is 52.1%. Where does that put us nationally?
I don't know the answer to that question, but I can definitely find out.
Thank you, Ms.
For you and get that information to you.
Okay. Senator Peterson, I don't know who had the... Senator Chamberlain, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Ms. Swisher. 52%. On my notes here that I've got for this session in this committee, one of the things I'm going to look at, I think we all will look at, is outcomes. So you mentioned 52% graduation rate for ELL students, and the goal of the ELL program was to improve that graduation rate. So what has been the progression over the years of that graduation rate? I'd like to think that we've gone from 2% to 52% and not stuck at 52%. Thank you.
Ms. Lesher.
If you could give me just a second. Also, that's a great point, and I will make sure that I get that information to you.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think with ELL learners, it's particularly important to look at overall graduation rate. I know we're looking at four-year graduation rate. Do you have the six-year graduation rate? I know you don't have it on the slide.
Yes, MDE calculates a 4, a 5, and a 6-year. And we don't have that with us, but we can get that to you.
Thank you. Thank you, members. These questions are very important. Again, we're going to come back, and we want to make sure that we have some answers to those questions. Please continue.
I wanted to continue by talking a little bit about who are Minnesota's English learners and to point out that we have at least three distinct groups of English learners and many more in our state. One of the groups are immigrant students or students who have immigrated themselves to Minnesota or whose parents have immigrated to Minnesota. We also have, not all immigrant students are English learners, obviously, but some of them are. We also have students who are refugee students. Minnesota receives a high percentage of refugee students who are directly resettled in Minnesota directly by the Office of Refugee Resettlement. And so refugees have a different visa type than immigrant people, and Minnesota is, because of our economy and job opportunities, is a refugee resettlement state. And I have a slide next. I have some information showing you where refugees are typically resettling in Minnesota. And the other group of students are migrant students, which is a very highly mobile population of students in our schools whose parents or sometimes the students themselves move to Minnesota for temporary agricultural seasonal work. And some of those students are English learners as well. This map just shows in 2011 of the primary refugee arrivals. Primary means coming directly from their country to Minnesota. That's a primary arrival. A secondary, we know that Minnesota gets a lot of secondary refugee arrivals who are settled in Ohio or California first and then move to Minnesota to be reunited with family. That's known as secondary. And we don't have statistics about the secondary resettlement refugees, but of the primary refugees, you can see that it's not just the Twin Cities where the Office of Refugee Resettlement actually settles refugees, but in various counties as well.
I have a question here. Perhaps Mrs. Montaño can help us with this. In terms of reviewing the resources that are allocated for these different groups, I know that there are specific resources, federal resources, that come from for the migrant families, migrant students. Does MDE receive resources? I also know that we have resources allocated to refugee families that receive support? Do we receive resources specifically for the education of these families in those two categories? Would it be appropriate for us to review resources attached to these particular students that come from different resources, from different kind of federal resources?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we do receive resources for the two populations, but it's very minimal. I believe with the migrant, it's roughly $2-3 million, and those funds are used to supplement above and beyond all other resources available to these students. Obviously, if they're here during the school year, they're enrolled in our districts, and they should have equal access to all services that other students in our school districts have the opportunity to engage in. And the migrant funds are federal funds, and they are to be used above and beyond any services that these students should have access to. With respect to refugee, we also have limited resources, and these resources are not used to provide direct service, but if I remember correctly, they are to provide services to the assistance to the districts for how to work with the refugee population, how to deal with some of the issues that the refugee populations come with, how to work with the parents. There's not enough funding to deal with the services because obviously they're in our districts and our schools, and they should be given the same access to all services as all of the students receive.
Ms. Montaño, but these are additional resources that go directly to the districts for the students.
Madam Chair, they are additional resources that go to the districts for students. I think the refugee, and maybe Ms. Lisher can be more specific, the refugee funds only go to a handful of districts. Not all districts receive it because they have to have the numbers. And because the migrant resources are limited, not all districts receive the funding, only those districts with the larger numbers. So, like I said, $2-3 million, and the bulk of our migrant students come in the summer. And so much of the dollars that we do receive go to serve these students who come here during the summer and then maybe leave during the summer or early fall. And so the resources for the students that are here during the school year have to be shared with the services that we provide during the summer for the students that come here.
Thank you.
And actually, we work with DHS on the program for refugee students, and that money no longer goes to districts. It goes to community-based organizations in districts, in counties, and there's an expectation that they're working with local school districts. It is a very minimal amount of money, but it doesn't actually go directly to the districts. And also, just to give you an idea of the numbers of migrant children that we have in the state, these are the children whose parents move for agricultural seasonal farm work. And, this number is impacted by drought and strikes and a lot of different factors. That number is also declining in our state. But this gives you an idea of the numbers of students who are here over the summer and for the full school year.
Thank you. Senator Kent.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This most recent discussion made me wonder, what is the percentage breakdown between the three groups, the immigrant, migrant, and refugee?
I don't have the exact figures, but the immigrant student group would represent the largest group. The refugee student group would be the next largest, and then the migrant student group would be the smallest. And then, within those students, remembering that immigrant students are students who have immigrated themselves or whose parents have immigrated here, or other family members. And so that is our largest group in Minnesota. And I hope we get a chance to hear from Minneapolis a little bit later, and they can also give you more information about that, the specifics there.
Thank you. Go ahead.
I'm going to transition now into a little bit about the basis for the programming that districts are offering students. And, you know, one kind of key concept here is that in order for students to achieve academically on as measured by our state content assessments, they must master academic language. And the field of English as a second language education has really moved in the last 15 years in terms of really figuring out what is academic language and what language is needed to be successful in school. There's a point at which, and we're studying this in our state, there's a point at which the level of English language proficiency impacts a student's ability to achieve in the content area. There's an actual point that we can see. We know that some students aren't proficient for other reasons, but what we're looking at is when is language that barrier and what can we do about that and who needs to do it. So Minnesota's approach, in Minnesota's framework, our approach is that students must acquire both academic and social English to be successful in schools, that the acquisition of academic English must be integrated with the acquisition of academic content. You don't just learn one thing in one spot and then apply it later. That those two things are very much integrated, and that all educators of English learners, not just the English as a second language bilingual education teachers, but all educators must have knowledge, skills, and tools to help students develop this notion of academic English. Students are actually sitting in English as a second language classes or classrooms in the traditional sense for a very small portion of their day, and they're working with their in math classes and science classes and social studies classes. And so this very much points to all educators. And that educators must be able to collaborate to effectively meet the needs of the kids. And that we need resources, tools, and approaches grounded in sound research. Some more recent ideas about academic language, one concept being that learning content means learning the language of that content area, not just the content of the content area, that one cannot do science with everyday language, with social English. We're not going to be very successful in a science class. That there is a great variety when it comes to academic language in terms of register, genre, and in a few slides we'll kind of look at some words and concepts that are related to the different content areas. That it's not just about teaching facts and skills, but it's a complex system of ideas, concepts, and relationships between language and content that work differently for first language acquisition and second language acquisition. And this notion, basically this notion of academic language, is the fabric that holds our knowledge and skills together. And when working with kids in the second language acquisition process, there are certain techniques and skills that educators can learn and can help them to be more successful teachers of English learners and of all students. One of these concepts that we talk about, or that English language professionals talk about, is this concept of bricks and mortar words, that teachers can really positively impact academic language when they intentionally include the teaching of these brick and mortar words, repeatedly expose students and intentionally expose students to these words. When we're just talking about vocabulary, and regularly use strategies to help students to use the brick and mortar words. The brick words that are the content-specific terms, the technical terms in a different content area, and some examples you can see within English language arts of the brick words would be irony, theme, conflict, etc. From math, we have the content words there. The mortar words, however, are these general academic words that are common terms in everyday communication. that the words that hold the BRIC words together. And some examples of how this might look in the different content areas, you can see on the slide here that, you know, from English language arts, words like implies, contains, reflects, represents, supports. Of course, this all leads to academic achievement in the different content areas. The difference with English learners is the need to be very specific and intentional with teaching academic language. I brought in also some factors that we know influence second language acquisition that districts must address in order to have success with students. Motivation, the student's motivation to learn, the age of the student, the age at which the student comes into the system, the access to language in the home or from their background, personality, of course, level and type of proficiency in the first language. As we have a lot of students with the refugee population, we have students still coming from refugee camps, a lot from Burma now with the Karen population, and students with interrupted schooling backgrounds. This definitely plays a part in their level of proficiency in their first language. The quality of instruction that they receive, the intelligence and disability.
Madam Chair?
Excuse me.
Factor in.
Yes, Senator Wiig.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Schlichter, how about parents?
Ms. Schlichter.
That's not on the slide, but of course, in all education, parental and family engagement is a key factor in working with kids and working with parents who are English learners. Themselves requires, you know, there's kind of a different way of thinking and about family engagement in general when we're working with parents who are English learners. So that's a excellent area to dive into further.
Senator Wiger asked an important question that is part of the legislation, and for both of you, Ms. Montaño and Ms. Leisure, our interest here really is to really talk about the administrative piece and mm-hmm. our responsibility with respect to how these programs are implemented, how the language that we have before us is actually being implemented at your level and this district level. So having a background on pedagogy is incredibly important, and I appreciate that this presentation helps us understand the pedagogy. But I'm more interested in learning, about really kind of what are the districts doing right now, what are some of the challenges that we face, what are some of the services that are being provided, what are some of the assessment tools that are provided, what are some of the specific programs that are being put in place to comply with this parent participation, the general requirements. How do you conduct evaluation of the different districts in terms of the requirements that are both in rule for teachers and programming in the legislation, and whether or not, you know, the resources that we have allocated here help districts, implement. I know that I receive a note from the director of the Minneapolis ELL program. She is here, and she wanted to speak about some of the work that they are doing. I am familiar with the Minneapolis story and how they have been using really local resources to really infuse more quality into the work that they do, because we are not providing the resources that are necessary at the state level. So I wanted to have a presentation more at a macro level in terms of resources and policy implementation than pedagogy. So if you could move in that direction, that would be helpful.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Johnson.
Kind of following up that question, it popped into my mind just as you, Senator Wiger, brought up your point. Do you make at-home visits? How much are they a part of the whole effort?
At the not at the Minnesota Department of Education. Home visits are not part of what we do.
No.
Some districts do with their family engagement plans, with their family engagement activities, do in-home visits. I know that St. Paul Public Schools has a big initiative around visiting with parents in the home, and then the cultural background piece is very much of the training they receive. I'm familiar with that program. I'm not sure, I don't have information about how widespread that is among Minnesota districts, but I do know that some are working in that area.
And just to be clear, yes, I did not think that the Department of Education would be going out to visit the families, but rather would it be a part of the goal or recommendation from the department that there be at-home visits, or even requirements that there be at-home visits?
That is not currently a recommendation that MDE makes, to my knowledge, but I will make a note of that suggestion.
Thank you, Ms. Montaño.
Madam Chair, in response to the series of questions that you raised and Senator Johnson, as with all programs that the Minnesota Department of Education works with, we have certain responsibilities, and we do know that the implementation of programs lies at the local level. We do not dictate what they should and should not do. We can recommend, we can suggest, we can provide frameworks, we can provide resources, but it is local autonomy, school districts, teachers, principals. It is their responsibility to determine the program and how they will deliver the services. Our responsibility is to provide framework, and to that degree, we have made sure that our English language, in terms of looking at our standards, I believe a year ago we were very adamant that we have standards that are conducive to English learners, and we came to you for approval to adopt the WIDA standards because we felt, as well as the teachers from the districts, felt very strongly that these were the good standards. They were standards that would lend themselves to make sure that our EL population had the skills to learn also the academic standards. We have provided an accountability framework as required by federal law. In federal law, we're also required to identify districts that whose students maybe are not achieving at the level that the state has determined they should be at. Our state legislation does not give us authority to go in and do any kind of auditing or monitoring in terms of making suggestions and recommendations to districts. Again, that is the responsibility of the local level. And so I do believe that as a state agency, we have provided the kind of resources, guidance, and framework and training. We do a lot of training. We've done a lot of training around the WIDA standards to make sure that districts are aware of how to implement them, how to utilize them. A lot of training around the various models with respect to services. And within the ESL model, there are numerous models all the way from pull-out to in-class to immersion. But ultimately, it is the district's responsibility to determine how those services would be offered. I do believe we have information in terms of how many districts utilize the various models to some degree, but not to the degree of how many hours or you know, to that extent. So I don't know if Ms. Lisher has any more to add to that in terms of the framework that the department offers to districts and in terms of the training and the kind of assistance that we provide and then and the accountability we do have. You know, we do hold them accountable, but our legislation, you know, only allows us so much authority or responsibility in terms of how exactly these are delivered.
So, Ms. Montaño, in terms of really understanding how this system actually works and what we do, do you collect information that will give us a clear picture of what's going on with these children? So when you talk about providing a framework, whatever that means, reviewing standards and providing an accountability based on federal regulations, not our own, and how there is total autonomy and independency. My question is, how do we know that these resources that we provide are sufficient? How do we know that things are working or not working? What does it mean to provide a framework? What does it mean to talk about accountability if ultimately the districts are working on their own? We provide a document and say, you know, go on and do the best you can. Could you tell us really what that means for you? How many staff members are working with the different districts right now? How much resources do you have within your own department to assist, you know, with technical support? Could you give us a more practical idea of what you do in terms of ELL?
Madam Chair, I can tell you that we, all our staff that work with the EL population are federally funded.
Okay.
Our agency has been cut repeatedly over the course of the last number of years. So all our staff that work with this population are federally funded. We have no state-funded positions that work with this program. In terms of the services that are being delivered and what is working and what is not working, we know that there are some areas where they are being very successful, and can share with you what they are doing in this area. Can we dictate, as with all other programs, not just this program, but reading, math, science, that everybody should do it this way? That is not anything that we can do. I believe this is a very good segue into our next presentation, because we are looking at the programs that are working, best practice. How do you take something that is working very well over here and transfer it to this other side and make sure that it is that it works? We've had a lot of experience where people will say, well, just identify all these best practices and put them out there. That's the what. It's the how where we fall down. You have to implement these with fidelity. It's not a cookie cutter. You have to look at the individual needs of each single school. Because it worked here, does that mean the population over here is exactly the same? Does it mean the teachers have the same level of understanding or training? So while we have some very successful models and practices, what we're going to talk about in the next presentation on the regional centers is the how and how do you implement these with fidelity and efficacy, and make sure that they are working. So we do have examples of models where some good things are happening. The regional centers that we're going to talk about are working with some of our focus and priority schools. And one of the areas we're working with is ELL, and going in and actually looking at what is happening and how do we turn that around and how do we give teachers the support on an ongoing, regular basis in terms of looking at changing what they do on a daily basis. So we're in a position to do that. We're very excited about it. But this notion of identifying best practice and saying we're done, put them out there, it's going to happen, hasn't worked, never will work. You really need a model and a framework that looks at implementation and the science of implementation and how do you take something successful here and put it over here. And we're not only looking at that with respect to our ELL population, but in all other aspects where we have, where we know there are some successful things going on.
Thank you, Ms. Montaño. And I really appreciate your response, because I want the members to really have a framework to have this conversation. Members, I feel that this is a problem that we need to put our hands around. This is a small group of children, a population that is growing. Yet, we have this model in place that says, you know, each district has their own way of doing their business, funding, best practices, doing innovative things. I think we have an opportunity, and that is the reason I put these presentations together, because I do believe that there is a lot of value in really funding and providing resources at the state level to provide that kind of support. When we have populations that are very small and spread out all over, I'm going to bring the map so that you will see the ELL population in your district. How much resources can you devote to that small population effectively versus having the state having a more proactive effort, best practices adopted so that they can help? I think that the next presentation can give you an idea of how much we can do and how far we can go when we implement the practices at the state level without interfering, with the local autonomy and ideas that may come from local resources and local governance. But I do feel that this is something I really wanted you to hear. I have been reviewing this for 6 years, and I believe it's imperative that we talk about how it works and how we could do better in terms of allocating resources and support at the state level. So if you want to move into the next presentation, I know I have Minneapolis here, and maybe after your next presentation we can give the Minneapolis School District an opportunity to present what they are doing. So the next item in the agenda is the Regional Centers of Excellence. I am excited to really hear what is happening here in terms of, again, what the state can do, is capable of doing when given a task and challenge to really think creatively. So I think that our state, the department has staff that are incredibly good and prepared to really face these significant challenges, and this is an example of how you're doing it. So please go ahead.
Madam Chair, with me today is also Steve Dibb, who is director for the Division of School Support and the Centers of Excellence that we are now patterning the expansion on is in his division, and so I've asked him to accompany me. Like I indicated earlier, these are centers that, let me backtrack a little bit. We have been talking about educational reform for many, many, many years. But when we talk about educational reform, we typically think about a school and a district. At the Department of Education, reform also means us. Educational reform goes to the state education level, also any regional levels that where services are provided to schools and districts. So one of the things we did was took a hard look at ourselves and said, okay, how do we change? How do we reform? Because here we are in Roseville. We have limited staff. We continue to have decreases. I believe that upwards of 65% of this department is federally funded. So how do we take limited resources in Roseville and make sure that we provide the kind of service that's going to make a difference? And so reform for us also meant how do we take a hard look at ourselves and how do we implement some kind of a model or a framework that's going to enable us to provide good services to districts. This past year, we took that challenge and we ventured into it. And so when we saw how successful and how meaningful the activities that we were working on worked at the federally funded ones that are working with the priority and focus schools, we decided this was time to look at how do we take this model and expand it to make sure that we have services out there for all schools, all districts. And I'm going to let Mr. Dibb then take it from there.
All right.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to share a brief overview of the regional center concept that we have in place. And we hope to answer some of the questions that you had from the previous presentation as we move along as well. And again, I apologize if there's any of this information that's redundant, but I think it builds a good foundation for where we're coming from in our presentation. In our current regional center concept, the key principle of the ESCA flexibility request, or the waiver, as Ms. Montagna mentioned, was to provide a state-developed differentiated recognition, accountability, and support system, those are words right from the waiver, to build the capacity of underperforming Title I schools. And so keep in mind, at this point, we are talking about a regional center concept that has one menu item in it, which is the Title I schools identified under the flexibility waiver. But the aim there is to build their capacity to improve student achievement. So guidance from that waiver, through the guidance, the department has created a partnership role to provide direct support and technical assistance. So getting back to your previous question about what is that direct support look like for Title I districts with identified schools, and again, the main purpose is to help them build capacity for meaningful change that will lead to improved academic outcomes for all students, and particularly that which is mentioned in the waiver of closing the achievement gap in the state and increasing those graduation rates that we've seen. This is actually taken right from the ESCA waiver. When we talk about the Centers of Excellence, the primary goal of the statewide system of support, as it's called, is to focus schools and districts on closing the persistent achievement gap between high and low performing students, especially the achievement gaps between minority and non-minority students and between disadvantaged children and their more advantaged peers. That is our charge statement as a department from the U.S. Department of Education in the waiver. So the goal, as it was set in the waiver, is to reduce by half the student achievement gap, increase graduation rates, increase proficiency, and accelerate growth. And we're going to do that by creating a statewide infrastructure that will support a common, coherent implementation of evidence-based practices. Those practices which have a research base under them that have data that show that they actually work with various populations of students. And we're going to apply the common principles of effective practice. Deputy Commissioner Montagna said earlier about the how and the what. Quite often when we work with schools and their school improvement plans, they can make a list of things they should do, various programs or computer programs or books they should buy. They have the what. Often it's about the implementation or how are they implementing those key components in the school improvement program. And the how is what our regional center concept likes to address. So through the support of the ESA waiver provisions and the funding coming from Title I school improvement funds, which are called federal 103G funds, the three regional centers of excellence are currently implemented with potential for future expansion. The new regional centers of excellence provide a focus and consistent delivery of services across the state. This new delivery system founded on evidence-based frameworks, again, based on those practices that we know are effective in schools and with groups of students of various types, can effectively support and implement new programs and practices with fidelity. We now have a partnership role in crafting a range of statewide services and supports to scale up these regional efforts across multiple school districts and multiple schools. This map illustrates the three regional centers as we have them right now, as we were able to fund with those federal funds. We have three partners in our regional concept right now, as we took competitive RFPs for the grants and scored according to the criteria of which the regional centers, or the statewide system of support as it's called by the federal government, to provide support services to these Title I schools. We had a number of proposals that were submitted. Three met the standard and scored at a proficient level. And our three partners in this case, one is located in northwestern Minnesota, and they cover that very large northern tier of the state. It is larger than a number of states in the country, so it has its own logistical issues with it in terms of getting staff around it. The reddish color is a partner in St. Cloud, and they have the center central part of the state all the way over to the South Dakota border and to the Iowa border. So, again, very large structure. And then the third partner is in Rochester, and that center works with schools in the southeast area as well as the metro area. Even though the regions seem very strange in structure, what we tried to do also is to balance the number of schools, of priority and focus schools in each of those regions. So, again, the number of schools in the northern region is roughly the same as the schools in the southeast metro region, even though the sizes are very different. Again, the three partners are Northwest Service Co-op in Thief River Falls, Resource Training Solution in St. Cloud, and then in the southeast, it is the Rochester Southeast Service Co-op. And they worked with us to create these regional centers. And each of those centers, we've gone ahead and hired with collaboratively with the service co-ops a staff. And the staff that is hired include four areas. They are reading specialists, math specialists, special education staff, and English language development staff that we've hired, and we like to consider the best of the best in the state, to go and work with schools. So as you can see on this slide, the department staff, or in this case the center staff, will work with regional center staff to determine the needs and provide support in math, reading, special education, and English language development. As we were developing the waiver, we would often sit on the phone conference call with the Department of Education in Washington. And almost every time we finished up a call, they always finished with one question. And we thought they were kind of kidding after the first time, but after the 10th time they asked the question, we thought, well, they must be serious. So we better pay attention. And the question was the same one every time. How is the SEA going to ensure that every English language student and every special education student is going to have access to and attain the Minnesota math and reading standards? How are we going to ensure that? So once again, they set a charge statement to us. Those are the targeted students, and not just because we need to work with EL teachers or special education teachers. These students are all teachers' students. And all teachers need to be proficient in the instructional modalities that are effective with special education students, EL students, and all the other subgroups that we are working with to help close the gap.
You have a question, so Senator Johnson.
Madam Chair and Mr. Dibb, you provided some answers when you told me where those regional centers were located. I would appreciate a brief history as to when this legislation went into effect and how it has progressed in Minnesota since the time. I apologize, I do not know about these regional centers of excellence.
Well, in 2001, No Child Left Behind Act was passed, and at that time, states, agencies that received Title I funds had the responsibility of providing support to those schools identified as not making AYP under the old system. There, at that point, over the course of about the last 10 years, funds flowed through these Title I funds flowed through the State Department and went to people out in the field, organizations in the field, that kind of took it upon themselves to find their own solutions to those questions of why are we not making AYP. And we found that the technical assistance received in one area of the state was not the same as other areas of the state. We found that the equity of the access to those services was not there across the state. So we wanted to make sure that all the students across the state were getting the same services, whether they're in Kellyer, Minnesota, or in Truman, Minnesota, or in Grand Marais. They are getting the same professional development and the same instructional strategies that any other student has. So with that, we started reconstructing the concepts around a regional delivery system about 18 months ago internally. And then with the delivery of the waiver coming last year, we thought this is the best time to launch this concept of a new consistent regional model. The waiver, if you remember, was approved in February of 2012. Based on that, then we launched our regional center concept in terms of hiring, taking the request for proposals, approving those, hiring staff all spring and summer long, and put it into full effect just this past fall.
So, Madam Chair and Mr. Dibb, so you're telling me that the regional centers really just started physically?
It really just started.
2012.
We rolled them out in the beginning of this school year, yes.
And are these in buildings, or where do you have them, in schools or courthouses? Or
The regional centers, you know, you kind of envision this big building with a marquee or whatever, but they're an office space is what they are in each of those three service co-ops, in Thief River Falls, St. Cloud, and Rochester. However, the staff spend 4 days a week working with schools. So they're not really in the center. They're out in schools every single day working with schools.
Ms. Montagna.
Madam Chair, if I could just add to Mr. Dibb's a response to Senator Johnson's question. We issued requests for proposals for centers. We invited districts, we invited existing service centers, we invited higher ed. It just so happened that the three that we selected happened to be from the existing service co-ops that we already have, and I believe we have nine of them. And so those were the three that met the criteria that we set forth in terms of what we, you know, our expectations in working through this regional center concept. And I think that it, as it turned out, it was a good choice because they already had the infrastructure. They had some of the connections and partnerships that since they are already out, you know, in the area. That we've been able to capitalize upon, and so with the centers, you know, they still exist, and MDE exists, and then with respect to the services that we're offering to our focus and priority schools, that's where we came and had collaboration and developed the services that we are providing for these schools that we're working with. So it isn't like we went out and created these different, you know, entities with its own separate. We issued requests for proposals, and we were open to whomever. And it just so happened that it ended up being three of the existing service co-ops, and so we're working very closely with them on these initiatives.
Thank you, Ms. Montaño. Senator Nelson, you had a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, actually, maybe more of a comment. I will just, for newer members, if you have not met yet with your service co-ops, they are a wonderful resource, and they've had great results. I really applaud the department for looking at our service co-ops as mechanisms for providing these centers for excellence. I can tell you the center in Rochester, even though it's only been in existence for 6 months, they've already seen great results in changing strategies, instructional strategies in different school sites. And I'm hopeful that we'll continue to see that. And I think I'm glad to offer an invitation. If anyone wants to come down to the Southeast Service Co-op in Rochester, I'll be glad to arrange that. I think we have a few Fridays left here before it gets real busy. But it's a great model. They've shown great success. And I'd encourage you to make sure you find those service co-ops in your own district.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Johnson.
Please. I understand that. I'm new here. So putting this into context helps me a lot to know that it just went into place, you know, 6 months ago. I didn't know that they were part of the service units. But rather, I thought it was a whole new group of centers.
Thank you.
That were put out there. And that's why I asked a very,
what a question.
One would call a very elementary kind of question. But in order to get my mind around this thing, I need to have that.
Thank you, Senator Johnson. I agree. I think that's important for all of us. Because even if we knew kind of where they come, the legislation came from, or the idea, the concept, we didn't know how it's working. So this is very, very good. please proceed, Mr. Jay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So again, I won't be redundant in what the staff does, but you can see it there. Again, it's a group of people that have been hired in collaboration with our partners right now that go into the schools. They work with teachers. They work with principals, help them determine their current status, and they do that through a very comprehensive needs assessment. Then they plan those strategic interventions that are data-driven. They have been proven to get results with various groups of students. And then they provide ongoing consultation, training, and technical assistance, and then monitor the progress and support modifications to the implementation as needed. And again, I can say from a previous model to this model, what we're hearing from our outstate schools is that finally they feel that they are getting the equitable services that they always have not realized in the past. And that's one of our barometers of how successful we are with this. We are constantly measuring. We have a very extensive evaluation that we are conducting of the center concept that we'll be able to present back to you in the future. So the success of these centers has then provided a foundation for expanding the efforts to further promote high-quality implementation of research-based practices to increase student outcomes. As has been previously mentioned, we have limited resources. We have the entire state of Minnesota covered by the regional centers, and we have I have one staff member working on the regional centers. That's it from the department. The rest of them are our staff that have been hired through the partnerships that work out in the regions. So we're looking for how can we expand this and establish partnerships with other organizations, as you see listed there, whether it's institutions of higher learning, different types of school districts, so forth and so on, and other partners as appropriate who can do this work. As was previously mentioned, we're looking for partners who have those relationships with schools that have the infrastructure to deliver programming. And our resources in terms of human resources, financial resources, technological resources just are not to a point where we're able to do a centralized type of delivery. So this really creates a mind shift from a centralized delivery system. As was mentioned, you know, everything does not always have to come out of Roseville all the time. We're looking at how can we reach out and, again, provide equitable services in a cohesive and consistent regional delivery system, provide services to all schools equitably. So when you take a look at our little diagram, you have the Department of Education, all the responsibilities of the Department of Education, you have the regional partners, and where the overlap right in the middle is where the regional center concept comes in. It's a partnership between the Department of Education and our partnership. Those are the centers. So, again, these types of partnerships will help increase our collective impact, the impact that we can have by when we have a new initiative that comes out the door by enabling centers to provide cohesive and coordinated support and equitable access, as we said, to all school districts. The support provided through the centers will be based on specific needs of each school. I think that's the key to our support. And as we were talking about our English language students, if that's a cohort of students that need addressing in the school, then that's what our regional staff work with the staff on. They really are, it's really data-based, taking a look at the student results, and working with teachers to put best practices in place to address the students and their challenge that they have in the school. So again, makes it very personalized. Our staff are in priority schools every single week. Now think about this: if you've ever been in a school building before, that you have the Maytag man or whoever coming in every week, sitting down with you, saying, "How's your school improvement plan going? Let's sit down and review that. What progress have you made?" I'm moving students forward. Where's your benchmark data on a weekly basis that shows your students are learning or not learning? And then if they're not, how are we going to help you move forward? So that's every single week those schools are getting support from the regional centers. Not we'll see you in 3 months, every single week. Like clockwork, they're in the schools working. And then they're providing professional development, math, reading, English language standards, special education instruction to those schools as needed. And again, we're looking at closing those achievement gaps. So we're transitioning from a delivery system for just the statewide system support, our Title I priority and focus schools, to a delivery system for all state and federal mandated initiatives to all the schools statewide. And that could include state and federal initiatives that include things like the principal and teacher evaluation program, the statute that was passed, our Minnesota state standards rolled out. Again, we have one math specialist in the state of Minnesota. We have one reading specialist and one science specialist. And try as they might, they can't get to all 400 districts in the state. So, but through our staff, and again, those three people, plus a number of other people, Ms. Schlesher's staff also sit on an advisory committee, and they work with our regional specialists to make sure the best practices are then scaled up to the regional level. So what we know as best practices of the state reaches the state, the regional and district level. And again, it gives us an opportunity to develop partnerships in the future with colleges, service co-ops, other entities to advance the school reform efforts to close the achievement gap, always keeping, as our commissioner likes to remind us, always keeping the student in focus. So again, for those who are visual learners, a model here to show that what happens in terms of planning and launching out of the State Department of Leadership is then scaled at the same level with our regional staff at our regional center implementation teams. So if it's a best practice that's been identified at the state level, it's a best practice that should be at the regional level, implemented at the district level, to the building level, to the school and teachers in the classroom, and hopefully impacting students and families. And what you don't see are arrows that go back the other way, which is the communication loop that then responds back through that same communication protocol. If it's not working, how do we make modifications? So it's not just a top-down, but it's a responsive response. We meet with our directors in each of the regional centers on a weekly basis. We meet with our center staff through phone conferences on a weekly basis. They get together every Friday and talk about what's going on at their region, and then we bring them in on a regular basis for ongoing professional development with our specialists at the Department of Education. So there's a constant flow of information back and forth, up and down through this diagram. And finally, the rationale here is to provide intensive technical support to schools, and that there's program consistency at all levels, from state right down to the classroom. One of our unofficial mantras in our regional centers as they work with schools is the work that we're doing with schools going to result in detectable changes in the classroom? Because if we continue to do what we've done, we'll continue to get what we've got. So what changes are we going to be able to see our actions in each and every classroom? And if we can't see that, then somewhere along that model, we've broken the connection. Collaborative teaming begins at the state level to improve results for all students at the classroom level. And that's why we're looking at expanding our regional center concept to take in more initiatives, the state initiatives and other federal initiatives as they come along, so that every student has access equitably to the state standards, to teacher evaluation programming, to whatever state or federal programming the agency is required to initiate.
Thank you, Mr. Dibbs. One issue, members, that I want you to remember, if you go back to the recommendations that the governor put together, there is a recommendation for $4.5 million for the Regional Centers for Excellence and $8.9 for ELL. So part of what I wanted to do with these presentations is really to give you a sense of what that is and how it works. You know, what are we doing at the state level with, you know, the programming, so that when we think about, you know, how are we going to use these dollars, then we have a context to ask, you know, what is happening with regional centers and what is that we need to expand. So we will be diving into that conversation in more detail as we move forward with the different legislative proposals. Do you have any questions, members? Senator Franson had a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In terms of getting more details, I'd be interested in finding out from the previous presentation on English language learners, the demographics. You've said you've seen increases from other countries like Burma. Like to understand more the deeper demographic shift, maybe in the last 3 or 4 years, whatever whatever would be useful for us to see the trends and where those demographics are in terms of languages and where what countries are coming from. Thank you.
Thank you.
Sure. We will provide that, Madam Chair, Senator.
Thank you, Ms. Montaño, Senator. Senator Chamberlain.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Regional centers, I'm not usually much of a guide for growing bureaucracies, but it looks like you have an approach here that if it's followed, it could be a great thing. So it'll be interesting to see how it proceeds. I know you don't have any real hard data yet because you just started. Perhaps you got some ideas, but it'll be interesting to see how this proceeds because I like your last statement. Will those changes you make, will they have detectable changes in the classroom? I think that's a great statement, and hopefully I think it should be a model for all government. But we'll start with this and be interested to see how it turns out. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. You know, one of the interesting things, as I was reading some of the progress you've made, is that I think this committee has an opportunity to think outside the box to see what is working at the local level and how do we connect, you know, some of those resources and those capacities to what we can do at the state level. I am particularly interested in looking at, as I said at the beginning, these kind of small groups, these small populations that we have to serve. I think that in terms of efficiency, how do we create in each district, if we have 400, you know, the capacity to really serve those few students that we have in there and give them the best tools, you know, to perform in the schools. I don't know how do we do this. So the regional concepts sometimes offer that opportunity, and I think you've done, you know, very creative things. So I want us to think about, you know, how do we utilize these few resources that perhaps we will put in place for populations like ELL populations and others that are just kind of spread out throughout the map, and we just really don't know how those specific districts are struggling. Senator Kent, did you have a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And your map that you referred to earlier may help address some of this, but as I've given thought to this, I happen to represent three fairly large school districts, and they each have some amount of economies of scale to deal with these populations more efficiently, but I keep thinking about smaller districts and the challenges, exactly as you say, of recreating the wheel time after time. You know, and then you hear these students speak so many different, come from so many different native languages. So I would be interested, and again, your map may handle this, but perhaps you would provide this information. How many English learners do we have around the state by district? You know, and I think it will be sort of eye-opening to really appreciate the challenges across the state. Thank you.
Yes, Senator.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A question. Are we still giving the TILA test for English language?
It's been replaced, but we do continue to test our English language learners. We do have accountability measures, and it's been replaced by other assessments, but we do still we don't call it that anymore, but we do still have those assessments, yes.
Is that perhaps that AMAO that was?
No, it's the access test, and through the WIDA standards, we do have assessments that look at speaking, reading, writing, or listening, speaking, reading, writing, and then reading is through the WIDA standards as well as our Minnesota statewide assessments.
And then a comment on teacher preparation for teaching special needs students, English language learners. Your comment on that. Do you think the state is adequate in what our expectations are for teachers entering those classrooms?
Senator, Madam Chair, I think the state has done a good job at teaching ESL teachers or preparing ESL teachers. I believe that where we need to go now, and I think Ms. Lisher talked about the fact that, for the most part, these students are with the ESL teacher for maybe an hour a day, and the bulk of the time is in the classroom. So I think that where we need to now focus on is looking at making sure that those classroom teachers and all the other teachers that come in contact with these students have the skills to be able to work with these students. If you look at where are they getting their science, where are they getting some of their content, they're getting it from the classroom teacher, and these teachers have had no training on how to work with these students. What are the barriers for these students? You know, depending on what language they speak, how does their native language have any, you know, interferences with English? You know, how many of you know that Vietnamese is monosyllabic? Every one of their words is one syllable. That has an impact on their ability to learn English. And so I think where we are focusing right now is looking at what kind of training do we provide the classroom teachers and other content teachers in terms of how to work with these students.
Maybe just a couple comments. Senator Nelson, I think your comment was absolutely correct about the older the student, the more difficult it is to learn that language. I think in 2003, 2004, we saw quite a few students coming from East Africa, and there was a lot of genocide taking place of certain tribes. And I remember we had three students enroll in our school, all males, and it's difficult sometimes to determine their age. You're not quite sure, but these three gentlemen looked more like men in the hallways. But they all graduated, and their last year they worked the night shift at a box factory and then came to school the next day, and they all graduated. About the dropout rate, I know I can recall one female student that was married by her parents to another family, and so she had to drop out of school. Every one of these students, there's a bit of a story. The most difficult student I remember dealing with that lacked English skills was a student from East Africa who was a sheep herder in his native country, was illiterate in his own language and writing skills. He was about 19, and now he came to the United States, and we were to teach him English. And that's a real difficult task. But I applaud you for your work. Thank you.
Thank you.
Some of the challenges, I remember the conversations we had to have with my children in sports and in soccer when we had, you know, these East African children who acted, you know, really at an older level, and this whole controversy around trying to figure out really how old these kids are because of their level of skill. This might be a good opportunity for us to hear from Minneapolis. I thank you, Mr. Grathwell, that you were paying attention to our agenda. Thank you to both Ms. Montaño and Mr. Dibb. I think that the presentation was very informative, and it helped us, you know, really understand how do we move forward in these areas. I am appreciative of your, really, you were paying attention to what was coming in the agenda. We were trying to really put together some ideas to give this information to the committee members. And I understand that the staff from Minneapolis School District is here, and I have been part of this conversation for the last few years. I'm excited about what is happening in Minneapolis. So thank you for being here and for asking for an opportunity to speak to the committee. So if you would like to introduce yourselves and just give us, I know that I didn't call for this and that you just wanted to give us a kind of informal presentation, that it will be, I think, incredibly helpful since you probably have the largest number of immigrant refugees in your district. It will be incredibly important for us to hear from your perspective. We understand that we did not call, so we don't expect a very formal presentation or clearly, you know, a PowerPoint presentation, but just share with us your thoughts and your journey until now.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Jim Grathwell, Minneapolis Public Schools. I'm joined by Jana Hillerin, our Executive Director of Multicultural Multilingual Services, and Muhyiddin Warfa, also in the department. Since we put this together on short notice, mercifully, we don't have a PowerPoint in the can for you. We're not going to suck the oxygen out of the room, but we thought it would be a good opportunity to have a conversation about kind of what the work looks like and how we're structuring and reforming our work. I'd like to turn it over to Jana.
Absolutely, Madam
Chair.
Thank
you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. This will be very brief, and it will be our reaction to the very exciting news that we are contemplating raising the five-year funding cap on English language learner allocation. So you may be aware that we had about 200 community leaders from...
Excuse me, yes. Mr. Hillerin, you have to introduce yourself for the tape.
I apologize.
If you could please tell us your name and where you work. That would
Absolutely.
Be very helpful.
My name is Jana Hillerin, and I am the Executive Director for Minneapolis Public Schools Multilingual Department. We are charged with the education of English language learners in the Minneapolis School District.
Thank you. Please go ahead.
So earlier this week, we had approximately 200 community leaders who had signed a petition saying that they strongly supported lifting the five-year funding cap on LEP allocation. This was presented to the governor's staff on Tuesday, and we believe that this is a reflection of the very strong work that is taking place in our district to reform the way that we educate English learners. We have developed a framework that is very much about collaborative services to these students, honoring the assets that they bring to the educational environment, and infusing a focus on academic language in all classrooms for all learners. Currently, we have 7,957 English learners enrolled in our schools. And of these students, 2,453, or 31%, have been receiving services for more than 5 years. So you may be wondering, why is it taking so long for them to attain proficiency? Research is very clear. The research of Kenji Hakuda is the most frequently cited research, that for social English language development is 3 to 5 years, but for academic language proficiency, it's 4 to 7 years. And it's also important to note that Kenji Hakuda's research looked at some of the more successful school districts in California and only included students who were continuously enrolled in their districts from kindergarten on. And we know that many of our English learners are not continuously enrolled in their districts from kindergarten on. So just an important point of reference. What is our obligation to these students as a school district? Our work is very much grounded in a recognition of the U.S. Supreme Court's interpretation of the Civil Rights Act, which is embodied in Lau versus Nichols, 1974 ruling, that said that local school districts and states have an obligation to provide appropriate services to limited English proficient students. It's really important to note that the Lau requirement includes no language regarding a time limit on this obligation. So we are, as I mentioned before, we are very much embarking on a bold reform effort as a district. We have worked very closely with national level experts, including Dr. Virginia Rojas, to make sure that our program models align with research and best practice. We also have an EL commission, which includes Valeria Silva from the St. Paul Public Schools, as well as other experts. And an important part of this has been the state's adoption of the WIDA standards. And I really want to commend the work that went into that. That has been a huge step forward for English learners. For the first time, we have what I would call comprehensive and rigorous standards that recognize the importance of learning content and language together. We have really powerful assessments that we can use to screen students when they come into our district, that we can use as an annual accountability measure. And what's really interesting about this work is we are seeking to infuse a focus on academic language in every single classroom. So it's not just about the support of an ESL teacher. It's about the child's entire academic day, entire academic career. And just as a point of perspective, in Minneapolis, in our K-5 classrooms, 4 out of 5 classroom teachers have at least one English learner. And I'm very aware from working with other districts that we are, as a state, moving in that direction, that increasingly every teacher is going to be a teacher of English learners. So it's absolutely critical that they have the knowledge and the skill set to infuse the focus on academic language into their teaching. One of the things that we know from our, we had our first round of access testing data this past spring, and our preliminary results were really interesting. WIDA gives students, there are five different levels of language proficiency that they can fall into. And what we notice is that students who are at level five, at a high level of proficiency, were 80% proficient on MCA reading scores. So they were exceeding what we have as a district average for MCA reading scores. And what that tells us is that if we are very intentional about focusing on academic language development, it will benefit not only these students, but we believe all students, and that it's a really critical point of focus for all educators. Another point that I just want to raise is around the funding. We currently receive $4.5 million in state LEP funding. And in turn, we use that to purchase ESL teachers. Our current staffing ratio is one ESL teacher for every 50 elementary students and one ESL teacher for every 75 secondary students. But it's important to note that we supplement that, that the state LEP allocation only covers 52% of our ESL teacher costs, that we tap into other district funding sources to make sure we can have an adequate program. So I think that's also a very important point of consideration for this committee. So.
Thank you very much, Ms. Hillinger. I think that we had a very good presentation a few months ago with the superintendent to talk about this number and how important it is for us to understand really that the district is using local resources to pay for half of the services that you provide to the students. And now that you have entered really into this much more aggressive and organized effort to serve these children, we need to support the efforts that you're doing, and we need to learn from you, because I also want to ask you, I know that you went through a very intensive training, kind of extensive effort to recruit and hire teachers, and that you struggle. Could you give us a sense, because I think we heard that from the department that we're doing okay in terms of recruiting and assigning teachers, but I know that you had to do extensive work in that regard because we really didn't have teachers. So could you speak to that issue?
We certainly find challenges in finding bilingual teachers. We, at a state level, it's very, very challenging to find bilingual teachers, and they are of critical importance if we are to have research-based bilingual programs. But more importantly, we believe that it's really important that our children have the opportunity to see teachers who come from their same cultural and linguistic backgrounds. So it has been a significant obstacle to find adequate numbers of bilingual teachers. We have added a number of ESL teachers, and that has been a very important part of our strategy to ensure that there is adequate service, that we are serving all of these students in a manner that aligns with research. We continue, much like MDE has recognized, that the role of the classroom and content teacher is also very, very important. So a big part of our work has been building the capacity of all teachers. No matter how many ESL teachers we hire, the child will still spend a good portion of their day with their elementary classroom teacher or with their secondary content teacher. So it's increasingly important that all teachers have the skill set to be teaching academic language, to be able to connect with these students, and to be able to ensure that they can teach the students that content.
Ms. Hillary, could you share with us the number of teachers you had when you started and the number of teachers you have now?
Yes. When I started, we had approximately, I think, 101 ESL teachers, and we did a comprehensive review of the services that we were offering to those students. Were we in compliance? Were we offering minimal services? And in some cases, we were not offering an acceptable level of minimal service, let alone reaching a point of excellence. And so with the support of the superintendent and the board, we added 52 additional ESL teachers. And so that's an incredible amount of staffing. And it's also important to know that our ratios are still fairly high. So even with that influx of significant numbers of ESL teachers, 1 to 50, if you think about being an elementary ESL teacher and being responsible for 50 students potentially across six different grade levels and potentially, you know, across 20 or 30 classrooms, it's a very significant challenge, and our teachers rise to that challenge every day. And that secondary level, 1 to 75, again, is a very high ratio. So we are working very hard and very creatively to make sure that we build the kinds of programs and the kind of schedules that ensure that students have high-quality services. And I suspect that this is a challenge for other districts as well.
Thank you. Thank you. Any questions from members? Senator Carlson?
Yeah. Madam Chair, and guess I can't remember your name. You said that there's a 1 to 50 and a 1 to 75 ratio. I believe the numbers of different languages you have are huge. Is there some particular languages that may have a 1 to 500 or some other number that's a little bit more startling?
So our ESL teachers are serving students of all languages. We do have some bilingual programs. We have, I think, approximately, we did a check last week, we're at about 64 languages. But the majority of our students fall into three language groups. Spanish speakers, our largest group and our fastest growing by far. Somali speakers, and then Hmong speakers. And so the ESL teacher is able to support students who speak any language. And in addition, outside of the state allocation for English learners, schools and the district have to make a commitment to ensure that we have bilingual staff so that students who do need that native language support, either for tutoring or clarification of instructional activities, and more importantly, for outreach to family and community members, again, that's a supplemental expense that the district and schools take on.
Thank you.
What you're saying is that it's not an absolute that you would have the bilingual speaker speak the language of the child
teacher. Absolutely.
Okay.
Thank you. Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, part of my question was answered there. I wanted a little more information on the bilingual aspect, and so you kind of touched on that. Did you have any outcomes to share with us?
I do not have that at this time. I would say that we have a lot of work to do. We have some strong positive trajectories in different buildings across our district, but part of the reason we embarked on this journey is because we want to improve our outcomes for English learners. And so we are starting in second semester of our framework, making sure that there is consistent service across all of our sites. So we hope to have data soon.
Senator Nelson, we are waiting for that.
Oh,
no,
okay,
we're also waiting for those results ourselves.
Well, just and yes. One specific piece on that data that I'll be waiting for and looking for is, now it's been a while since I've reviewed the research on bilingual education, but I know there was kind of a lot of controversy and mixed results. And so what I'd like to specifically see in your data as it comes before us is specifically, I'd like to see kind of a couple sets of data. One,
absolutely,
student performance in general with the ELL population, but specifically the bilingual aspect. We know that's a real gift in our society and a real advantage to be bilingual, but we also want to know exactly how do those bilingual resources affect student outcomes.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
The research is very clear that a well-designed and well-implemented bilingual program will yield stronger results than the support of just an ESL teacher. And that is a critical part of the work that we're doing to make sure that our programs are well-designed and well-implemented.
Senator Johnson.
Madam Chair, I will not ask any more questions today, but I'm wondering,
please do ask questions.
How do you train your teachers? Excuse me, Madam Chair. How do you train your classroom teachers to teach students that are do not have the skills of the English language? Do they have extra preparation time, or do they have extra teacher training time?
Yes, we have a comprehensive professional development plan And I think another key area of partnership has been when a school is in a school improvement process through Title I, if they are identified for English learners, we work very closely with the school to ensure that there are some strategies built in so that all teachers and all staff members in that building develop their capacity to deliver sound instructional strategies that will increase the success for these students. So school improvement planning is a key vehicle for us. We offer a comprehensive PD plan. We have many, many teachers who are very anxious to brush up on their skill set. It may not have been part of their initial teacher licensure process, but you know, we know teachers are a very committed group of people, and so we have some online modules that we've started to share with other districts across the state. We have traditional professional development. So we are very much engaged in professional learning as a group of educators in our district.
Senator Wieger.
Thank you. Madam Chair, could you comment on how parent involvement, engagement is used, and especially with the complication where they may not speak English?
Yes.
But you have to have that as a part of your effectiveness strategy.
So I'm going to invite Muhyiddin Warfa is in charge of leading the work around family and community engagement, and he will speak about some of the strategies we're using. I just want to preface it by saying our strategies are developed with our parents. So we do focus groups. We do work with community elders, community leaders, to really talk about what are the needs that the parents have. Obviously, we want to make sure they understand their child's academic journey, they understand the programming that we offer, but then we really try to tailor it to make sure we are being responsive and co-constructing the focus of that work. So if you want to speak.
Please make sure you introduce yourself, full name, if you could spell your last name for us, and then give us the title, you know, the office that you represent.
Thank you, Senator Torres. It's good to see you again. We've spent last year several times with community leaders testifying to you about our Minneapolis Multilingual Department's work on English language learners. My name is Muhyiddin Warfa. Our last name is spelled W-A-R-F-A. I'm the director for community outreach for the district for ELL learners. And Mostly, our work with the parents of our students is for them to understand the academic work of the students in the district. And so we do this in several ways. At the district level, we usually have five community meetings per year in the main three languages, specific Somali, Spanish, and Hmong. Actually, we have the next parent meeting on February 6th. Our superintendent will be there. Our district leadership are there, and then we have our program facilitators come to speak about the WIDA access results. And so with the three language families together, we have interpreters who, as one teacher speaks in English, then we have interpreters interpreting at the same time, so they have the instruments on their head where they can tune to the specific language. And so usually we explain to them what the WIDA access results means for their students, what the scores mean, and so they can understand how their students are doing in their classrooms. So that's at the district level. Also, we have resources on our website. So we have developed three language speakers in our department, and they developed video resources so that when families, you know, cannot come to our community meetings, they can go to our website and review those video resources in those specific languages to understand the programming that we do. And it's not just the academic work, but also we try to explain to our families why they have to take on ELL services. There's a lot of stigma attached to ELL services, and a lot of our families, especially from East Africa, they don't want to be seen as the new students who don't speak English well, and once they see the ESL teacher in their classroom, even if you don't say who this teacher is, they're smart enough to know, okay, we have a second teacher because I don't speak English well, and they're coming to do that. So we generated videos telling them that, you could be born here. It's not only people, new to the country. It's not a student who just got off the plane who's learning English. We have students born here, and then they have this the social language, but then they may not have the academic, and mostly it's they don't have the academic understanding. And so we make videos of those so they can see other students who are born here and who can testify to them that, okay, I'm born here, but I'm learning. This is important for me. And finally, the third way we reach our parents is that we go to the local grocery stores, local gathering spaces for communities. For the Somali community, the Brian Call Center at Seward, it's a center of gathering. So we go there and talk to families over there. We also go to the market. So we go to La Alborada Market, Latino Market in Lake Street. We go to the Somali malls at 24th and Lake Street there, and we go to special HIA Hmong families gather in the Hmong International Academy schools. And so when we go to this market, sometimes we go there with our language speakers, and then instead of going to the, it's very hard to go to the specific homes of families, so it's easier to go to these gathering centers, and then we just talk to families and say, okay, are you a Minneapolis student family? Do you have families in the Minneapolis school district? Mostly we don't have takers. People are very busy running off for their day, but the few we can get, we talk to them and say, would you like to know more about the academic work that we do in the district? And so that's how we try to reach a lot of families. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Werfa. We are approaching the end of our committee time, so I really thank you for bringing your perspective. And clearly, we're going to be mapping out our districts and inviting districts to present their perspectives and ideas, and really learning from you, because that's what we need to do in order to really shape our policy at the state level. So thank you for being here. Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Before we adjourn, might I ask two questions? One of the department, are they still in the room? I'm wondering about the list of rules that was promulgated by the department over the last year. That report was to be delivered to us by the 15th.
Ms. Montaño, if you could take a seat and just...
Senator, Madam Chair, I didn't hear the question.
Could you repeat the question?
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Montaño, I'm looking for the list of rules that the MDE promulgated over the last year. Those are to be delivered, I think, by last week sometime, maybe. Are those in process, or are they coming?
I'm going to let our government relations people, their job is to make sure those get out.
Okay,
thank you.
Madam Chair, members, thank you, Senator Nelson. Yes, I did.
Make sure
I'm sorry. Yep. My name is Darren Cordy. I work in the Government Relations Office at the Minnesota Department of Education. I did email out the report that was issued by our rules coordinator at the department, and I emailed it to the chairs of the committees, as well as I believe I did include the minority leads. But I will make sure I resend that to you as well. If I didn't include that, and I also included the chair of the I sent it out to all members of the LCC as well as that was required by statute.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cordy. I don't know that I'd received that yet, so thank you. And Madam Chair, might I introduce my intern before we leave?
Absolutely.
All right. Julia is my intern. And if she could stand up, please. I'm glad she's with us today. She's a student at the U of M, and she's the student representative to the Regents Board.
Oh,
so
wonderful.
I'm very glad to have her working with our office and have her joining us today.
Absolutely. Thank you, Senator Nelson. Any other final comments or questions? Well, again, thank you to the Minneapolis staff and to the department staff for the overview. We will continue the conversation, and we will announce the agenda for our next meeting pretty soon. Thank you, members. And with that, we will adjourn.